From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we've got an eye on the White House right now, where Bernie Sanders is meeting with President Obama. Perhaps we will find out more about Sanders' next steps now that Hillary Clinton has amassed the delegates she needs to claim the Democratic nomination for president. The president of the United States talked with Jimmy Fallon yesterday for a Tonight Show segment that is set to air later tonight, and Fallon asked President Obama about what he was going to say to Bernie Sanders.
The main role I'm going to be playing in this process is to remind the American people that this is a serious job.
Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Elsa Chang, who is also keeping an eye on the White House. Hi, Elsa.
Hi there.
And they've been in there for a little less than an hour at this point. Any idea of what's been said? We saw the images of them walking along the side of the White House. They looked like they were having a good time.
Right. I think we counted two backslaps along that walk through the colonnade. Right. There's been so much speculation, but the main message that White House officials have been transmitting so far is that the president is going to give Sanders the space to decide on his own, his timing of when to get out of this race. You know, that Sanders has earned the right to make his own decision about how to wind down his campaign. And the White House has tried to be very respectful of the movement Sanders has inspired. You know, the president has been mindful about not officially endorsing Clinton before this meeting with Sanders today, because they get it. They get that a tremendous and extraordinary amount of personal and collective investment goes into a campaign like this, all that energy and emotion. And it's not something you just tell someone to shut down right now.
But do you expect President Obama after this meeting to come out and endorse Hillary Clinton at some point today, or will that come later, do you think?
We do expect the president to endorse Clinton as soon as this week. I don't know if it's going to be today, but that endorsement should be pretty imminent.
Is there an expectation that Sanders will drop out of the race before the primary in Washington, D.C. for the Democrats, which is next week?
Right. So far, there's no real indication that that is his plan. Sanders has made it very clear repeatedly that he intends to remain in this race through the Democratic National Convention in July. He's holding a rally tonight in D.C. in anticipation of next week's primary here. And this week he's been sending out fundraising emails. This past Tuesday night, when Clinton had claimed the Democratic nomination, you know, the first woman ever to do so, Sanders didn't really dwell on the historical nature of that moment. Instead, he vowed to stay in the race. He rallied his supporters to stay by his side. So, yeah, by all appearances, he's proceeding full steam ahead in this race.
Well, and I get the sense from listening to what some of his supporters are saying that part of that is about just keeping this message alive, the message of his campaign about income inequality and the, you know, the 1% and Wall Street and the power that they have, keeping it alive as long as possible so that going into the convention, the Clinton campaign is forced to really take those issues on right up front.
That's certainly key here. You know, a lot of his supporters say the longer that Sanders stays in this race, the longer Clinton will have to pay attention to what that progressive wing of the Democratic Party wants. However, on the flip side, you know, Sanders is in a position when he returns to the Senate to be a power player, to be someone potentially at the table when it comes to reshaping the policy priorities of the Democratic Party. But how influential his role will be in the Senate in many ways depends on how he conducts himself over the next few weeks or months, how he gracefully and how generously he exits this campaign. I've talked to a number of Senate Democratic colleagues of his who say that how they receive Sanders when he comes back to the chamber will totally depend on these next few weeks. You know, many of them are watching, will he be a team player? Will he be someone who can unite the party behind Clinton? Will he call on his supporters to believe in her? And if he can bridge that divide, if he can help them defeat Donald Trump, of course his stature and clout in the Senate will rise. He could really have a seat at the table when it comes to policy priorities like income equality and like climate change and college affordability. However, if he goes into this July convention and tries to flip superdelegates who plan to vote for Clinton, this is something his campaign says they are planning to do, at least thus far, that will cause some ill will.
Well, and in fact, the one senator who had endorsed Bernie Sanders, Jeff Merkley of the state of Oregon, has now come out and said, we have our nominee and it's important for Senator Sanders to link arms with Secretary Clinton. There's another very big power player in the Senate, and that's Senator Elizabeth Warren. Is she going to play a key role because she's so loved by the left in this country in bridging this gap between the two?
She's considered to be someone who has absolutely a key role in bridging that divide, whether or not she's actually named as a presidential pick for Clinton. She's a powerhouse fundraiser. She can rally that progressive wing of the Democratic Party. She talks about the same issues that Bernie Sanders has been talking about. She will play a pivotal role in this campaign.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Elsa Chang as we watch what's going on at the White House, where Bernie Sanders is meeting right now with President Obama. Elsa, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, today, defense ministers from Syria, Russia, and Iran are meeting in Iran to talk about Syria. Just this week, Syrian President Bashar Assad pledged his troops will reclaim every inch of territory lost since the civil war started more than 5 years ago. Russia is helping Syrian government forces as they try to close in on Raqqa, the ISIS stronghold. The U.S. is backing a rebel force around Manbij, a city held by ISIS. Reuters reporter John Davison is following all of this from Beirut, Lebanon. And John, we remember Russia made a big point of saying it would end its military campaign in Syria. It was accused of bombing civilians and rebels who oppose Assad rather than ISIS. But it didn't end.
Russia did announce that it was going to pull out a large contingent of its forces in March. And it did so. A lot of warplanes returned to Russia. It pulled some of its forces out. But it is still very much involved in the conflict on the side of President Bashar al-Assad with airstrikes, both in the fight against Islamic State in northern and eastern Syria and also against other rebel groups.
Well, I mean, you say other rebel groups. Does that mean civilians? I mean, this seems to have sort of just gone under the radar.
There have been incidents where Syrian or Russian warplanes have been reported to have targeted, for example, hospitals or other civilian areas. So this is something which has been reported in the media, but it's definitely been on a large scale, and they've been hitting areas where rebel groups are in control or where ISIS is in control, but on occasion hitting, you know, civilian targets.
Well, what about what the U.S. is doing in Syria? Is this just from the air? Is it advice on the ground when it comes to backing another force working around Manbij?
Yeah, well, the U.S. is backing forces, Syrian Arab and Syrian Kurdish forces around Manbij and also in neighboring Raqqa province. It's backing them with airstrikes and also with special forces assistance on the ground. President Obama approved for about 300 U.S. special forces to be deployed on the ground inside Syria. So these would be the guys who are supporting the Syria Democratic Forces.
What is the sense of, you know, any kind of a shift? Or it seemed as if Assad made his declaration, and at least visibly we did not see a lot of reaction. What's been the reaction to that, his declaration that his troops are going to reclaim every inch of territory?
I mean, that's a claim which will be very difficult for him to back up. It's the Syrian army has been advancing in some areas against Islamic State, and the Syrian government forces and their allies have been advancing against some rebel groups as well. But it's been fairly slow going. They've retreated in some other areas. So the idea that they will be able to take back every inch of territory in Syria is basically extremely unlikely to be realized.
What's your sense of what's going on in the meeting in Iran with Syrian, Russian, and Iranian defense ministers?
Well, I mean, Russia, Syria, and Iran are all allied in their fight against both Islamic State and against Syrian rebels. So presumably this is, you know, coordination in the fight against both those enemies.
No. No sense, especially with attempts at peace talks, no sense that it might be a how do we convince Assad to step down?
I think it's a little early to say that. And then also, depending on who you talk to, different people will tell you that Iran supports Assad to a greater extent than the Russians do, or support the personality of Assad more than the Russians do, and some people would argue vice versa. So I think it's a little early to say whether they'd be trying to put pressure on him to step down.
So a civil war that's gone on for more than 5 years, maybe 400,000 people killed, and the flow of refugees that's completely reverberated throughout Europe. Any sense of that flow stopping or stemming?
I think the flow of displaced people appears to be continuing. I mean, there's been escalation in fighting in Aleppo province particularly, and we've seen thousands of people fleeing fighting recently, including between IS and other groups. So the flow of displaced people will continue. They have in some cases been blocked from entering into Turkey. So a lot of them are sheltering near the border and kind of trapped between the fighting and the Turkish border. But we're still talking about vast numbers of displaced people in camps or trying to leave the country, and also just hundreds of thousands besieged in various cities and towns across the country by different warring sides without enough aid or food. So the humanitarian situation in many areas is dire.
John Davison, reporter for Reuters, watching the situation in Syria. John, thank you.
Thank you.
An average trip to the emergency room costs more than $1,200. A one-month stay in a nursing home, about $7,000 a month and rising. And that, coupled with a rising aging population, is pushing the government to rein in Medicare spending and improve the health of older Americans. Well, a program that links health care and other services to affordable housing complexes in Vermont is doing both. Nina Keck of Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio reports.
It's just after 1 p.m., and Karen Crossman pays a visit to 88-year-old Lloyd Pigram.
Hi, Lloyd. How are you?
Crossman is a care coordinator for the nonprofit group SASH, which stands for Support and Services at Home. She regularly checks in on Pigram and 100 others who live in Templewood Court, an affordable housing complex in Rutland, Vermont.
So you've been weighing yourself?
Yeah. Pigram didn't always get such helpful attention. Crossman says last year, before he became a SASH client, the retired long-distance truck driver visited the ER 19 times.
So I said, well, I got to stop this.
The hospital agreed, which is when SASH got involved. Molly Dugan is SASH's statewide director.
What's unique about it is that we are using the affordable housing as a platform for delivering health care and social supports.
She says staff members like Crossman set clients up with primary care doctors and specialists, mental health counselors, and other available services. They educate residents about fall prevention and teach them how to read food labels. Lloyd Pigram suffers from high blood pressure, so he has to watch his sodium.
So no more beef broth and no more tomato juice still, right?
No, not yet.
Okay.
He says that helps, and he's been able to greatly reduce his visits to the ER.
If I go at all, it's because of an emergency, but it shows things have got better.
Better and less costly, according to an independent analysis by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Molly Dugan says that analysis shows Medicare spends $1,500 a year less on SASH participants than on similarly aged people not in the program. Emily Rosenoff is a senior policy analyst with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She says what makes Vermont's SASH program unique is it's been able to do it on a statewide scale in a sustainable way.
We're excited about this. HUD and HHS have been partnering together to see where there are best practices, and we really see SASH as a promising practice.
In January, $15 million in federal funding was made available to affordable housing providers nationwide to study ways to develop a model like SASH. SASH Director Molly Dugan says it didn't take long for their phone to start ringing.
The interest is there, and so now this is the next step in actually getting it to be replicated throughout the country.
She says there's nothing in this model that can't be created in another state. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
So, you know the music of Judy Collins. It's the law. Everybody sing.
Goes and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air.
If you didn't listen, your grandmother did. This is Judy's huge 1967 hit version of Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. But we were curious about some deeper cuts. Here's Since You Asked. Judy wrote it right around the time she lost her young son in a custody battle for several years while she fought alcoholism.
What I'll give you since you've asked is all my time together. Take the rugged sunny days, the warm and rocky weather.
As a teen, Judy Collins attempted suicide. After she got sober in 1979, she came to see addiction and suicide as twin mental health issues. Her son Clark grew up to wrestle with both. He completed suicide in 1992 after 7 years off heroin. Then there's Judy's My Father, the tale of the man who never fulfilled his dreams, inspired by her own father, the blind disc jockey who never missed a show despite his alcoholism.
My father always promised us that we would live in France. We'd go boating on the Seine, and I would learn to dance.
And I can't believe how it still pierces the heart. Who knew that Judy Collins would have that much pain? She was the envy of everyone. Stephen Stills wrote Sweet Judy Blue Eyes for her. But the song Judy Collins sings now is Get Mental Health Help. She's in Boston to be honored with the McLean Award from McLean Hospital for her advocacy. Judy Collins, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Do you have that happen that people say, oh my God, that song?
I know, it gets me too. And I realized as we heard the piece of it that one of the things about it was that I wrote it 3 weeks before his death. He didn't ever hear it, but I figure he's always heard it now.
Yeah. Well, and then talk about the alcoholism, the family alcoholism, which it is. I mean, it's a family
illness. Yes, it is.
Illness.
I had it, of course, and I just celebrated 38 years. Absolutely a miracle that I got off the train, one of the lucky ones.
You know, what was it like? You became sober, I'm sure still in some part of your heart mourning your father, the alcoholic, and then having to watch your son.
The worst. The worst. And he committed suicide in relapse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how I got over it, really. You don't get over it. I shouldn't put it that way. You get through it, however, and people reached out to me. There was a kind of a cluster of women, Mariette Hartley and Iris Bolton, Joan Rivers. Joan called me one night from Las Vegas while she was in the dressing room getting dressed. And she said, I know, it was about 4 days after his death, she said, I know you want to stop working. I said, you bet. I've already canceled everything for the next year. I said, you know, bury it. I don't want to even look at it. She said, you can't do that because you won't recover unless you keep working. And she knew that because she'd lost her husband
to
from
suicide. You said at the time, his suicide has both ruined my life and probably saved my life because I have to live through it. I have to get through
you
it.
You have to. I have to. I was determined. Then I had to learn, how do I not kill myself today? And it happens for a lot of issues in terms of our lives, you know. I just won't do that for today. Or somebody
for
said,
today.
You know. And I think that's part of our search for mental health. The ability to stabilize your own sometimes erratic emotions. If you know where you can finally wind up, I'm in AA. I've been in AA for 38 years. I will never not be there because that's where the recovery is. And we have had over the past 10 or 15 years a kind of revolution in our attitude about this. Mm-hmm. This is not a secret. This is not a big, terrible, dark secret.
Yeah, there is a change now, viewing it as a disease.
We now have a man who's the head of the Drug and Alcohol Commission, Botticelli is his name. I saw him on television the other day when he said the moment he walked into a meeting and he got it, his eyes teared up. You know, I said, that's right. I mean, that's mine did too when I heard him say that, because when you understand that there is a solution, you said it was like wrestling with a jellyfish.
Oh, we were talking earlier. I said mental illness is like wrestling with a jellyfish.
I will quote you now from now on because it is. However, there are many solutions. And frankly, human contact with other people who are awake is a big start. I'm very happy that my life is one of sobriety and of living a day at a time and of working. And I'm so grateful that I've been able to work. I have this brand new album, which is sort of, to me, it's like a lifeline and a new world. It's about the continuity of creativity. And, you know, you cannot do that when your head is buried in a bottle. I just do not believe that what happens when we're completely out of it doesn't kill the things in us that are alive and happy and joyful and able to spread the word.
Well, we have some of the new CD, Silver Skies Blue, with singer-songwriter Ari Hest. Let's listen to a little of the title song.
As the scent of spring arrives, I will dance you through the green, guiding every new footstep till you recall our routine.
For those who, you know, you papered their dorm walls, you know, we know the Clintons named Chelsea after you know. Does it help at all, and maybe even propel you, that while you couldn't do it for yourself for a long time, you were doing so much for everybody else?
Well, I was also keeping myself alive and thriving because the music and the artistic aspects of everything in my life were there. I'm the first person that gets the benefit of all of that.
Right.
So I was staying on the planet, and there was a lot of beauty and wonder and extraordinary experience in those years. And until I really went down at the end of 77, and I really thought it was all over because I couldn't sing either. In many ways, I was thrilled, of course, with the life I had, and I was ecstatic much of the time when I wasn't passed out. But you cannot keep that up.
Right.
You cannot.
I'm wondering if we hear any of those early struggles, your son, when he was taken in the custody agreement. Mm. Do we hear any of that in the music that you wrote?
I don't think that there's so much a biography. But I think art takes over and makes out of what you are living something that is of you. But it doesn't have to be autobiographical. It tells the story. I think the voice may tell it. I think you may hear it in the quality of the voice more than any place else. I believe that.
Yeah. Judy Collins, the latest recipient of the McLean Award for Advocacy, given by McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, for her advocacy on mental health issues, and her new album, Silver Skies Blue, with Ari Hest. Judy Collins, what a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Cleveland Cavaliers made a U-turn in Game 3 of the NBA Finals last night.
Turns it over. James keeps his dribble somehow. Irving back to James. Oh, he throws it down.
LeBron James slam dunk, punctuating Cleveland's 120-90 win over the Golden State Warriors last night. The 30-point Cleveland win followed a 33-point Cleveland loss in Game 2 of the series. Now Golden State, the defending NBA champions, lead the best-of-seven series 2-1 with Game 4 Friday night in Cleveland. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. He joins us now. Mike, what happened?
Well, I think what happened was Cleveland asserted itself as a team deserving to be in the NBA Finals, a team with LeBron James, and importantly, behind LeBron James, at least competent players. And in this game, Kyrie Irving, who had 30 points, was more than competent. He was truly excellent, and he had been truly terrible in the first two games. You know, we could talk about things like defensive switches and what did Cleveland find out about the Warriors that they hadn't been able to crack in the first two games. But you know what? I think so much comes down to when you're jump shooting teams, and both of these teams are, this incarnation of the Cleveland team is. I mean, Kyrie Irving's shots were just going down, and they weren't in the first two games. And conversely, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, they were missing. I mean, Steph had 19 points, not a terrible game, but those three players, if you include Draymond Green, combined for 35 points, the lowest that those three have ever combined for in a game since 2014. So, you know, you add it all up, and hey, you just said 30 points.
Well, and it also makes you wonder how important the home court advantage is here, that Cleveland won on its home turf, Golden State had won big on its home turf.
Yes, I think the two huge things that it underlines is just that. And let's also note that the Warriors, when they play away games, especially game threes, which it's not just a random, you know, number, random number statistics. It's game three is the first time you play an away game. So they're a little out of their comfort zone. The other team senses momentum. So in game threes on the road, they've lost five straight. Okay, that's an important thing. But the other thing to remember is when assessing, oh, does Cleveland ever have a chance of even making it a series? And I admit, I was wondering that. You can't look at margin of victory because the Warriors play this highly variable, intense style where a close win, or a blowout win, I should say, for them is a little like a close win for another team. When things work in a huge way. So we're going to see blowouts, and that's going to convince you they just absolutely can't lose. But they can lose, and they did lose.
Mike, switching gears here, because I just want to get your thoughts on this before we let you go. Russian tennis star Maria Sharapova says she will appeal her 2-year suspension for a positive drug test for a banned substance. Is this punishment justified?
Well, I think it is. This is part of the tennis authorities told everyone, and everyone in tennis should have known that this substance, melodium, which was legal in Russia and some former Soviet states, was no longer being allowed, and she had ample notice, and she was taking it. And she claims that it was for medical purposes, but that doesn't seem to be in keeping with actually how the drug is used. Let's note that the suspension was backdated to January, so she'll be eligible to play in a year and a half. And let's also note that women's tennis now is Serena Williams and a lot of people who are, you know, lesser than Serena Williams.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
The Republican chair of the House Select Committee on Benghazi says Democrats will be allowed to review the report describing events surrounding that 2012 terrorist attack on a U.S. compound in Libya before its release, which could be this month. Democrats have said the report from Congressman Trey Gowdy's committee is politically motivated, aimed at hurting Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State during the attack. The story of the attack has been made into a movie, which is out this week on demand and on DVD. It's called 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. And it's based on a book by Mitch Zuckoff. We spoke when the film first came out, and we started by setting the scene of the attack. September 11th, 2012, in Benghazi, east of Tripoli. There's a diplomatic outpost for the U.S. there and a secret CIA station.
It's important to start there because this is a story that we really want to focus on what happened on the ground that day. So much has been focused on Washington and elsewhere. You have these two compounds separated by about a mile, and the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador who's normally based in Tripoli, has just arrived there in Benghazi, and he's based at this little diplomatic outpost, very lightly guarded. And 9:42 that night, suddenly Islamist, radicals burst through the gates, and they set fire, and immediately the compound is overrun. The five diplomatic security agents who are there are forced to take cover, and they begin setting fire, and the call goes out, please come help us. And the call goes over to that CIA annex where there are six men who are called GRS. This is the Global Response Staff. They're the security team for the CIA. And they immediately jock up and get ready to go.
And the ambassador at the diplomatic compound is actually killed by smoke inhalation. That's what kills him because the Islamists, as you say, light the place on fire.
Exactly.
Later that evening, the CIA station is also attacked.
Exactly. So the guys from the CIA station do respond, but because they are held back, because there is a delay, they are not able to get to the diplomatic compound in time to save the ambassador or Sean Smith, who is an IT guy who was there with the ambassador. And then when they return to the CIA annex to protect that place, it is again attacked repeatedly over the rest of the night.
Now, as you said, this has gotten to be a very political story. I want to play a clip here from Fox News, from Bill O'Reilly, because this is what you hear in a lot of the media right now when you hear about the attacks on Benghazi. Here he is.
No one in Hillary Clinton's State Department was held responsible for the debacle in Benghazi. No one. And that's likely to be the end of the story, except for one thing. Hillary Clinton's running for president. So now we, the people, have to decide whether she is a leader we can trust.
Now, Hillary Clinton is not in this film at all.
That's
why not?
Correct. Because it is not a political movie. It is not about what happened in Washington that night. It's understandable. We know what's happening in the world right now politically, but it's not about her, and it's not about what the decisions were that night.
Are you saying the attack on Benghazi has nothing to do with Hillary Clinton?
Not that it has nothing to do with her. I understand the implication, and she has taken responsibility for the failure, and the clear failures of the State Department happened before this attack. This was so lightly guarded, this diplomatic compound. It didn't satisfy the requirements of an embassy or a consulate because it was neither. And so when the Accountability Review Board reviewed this, they said these were you know, horrible failures by the State Department. And so that does fall to Hillary Clinton as the head of the State Department at the time. And she has both publicly and in her book taken responsibility for those failings.
There are also clearly failings by any other branch of government capable of helping these people during the attack. As you, the title is 13 hours. 13 hours going by when the Defense Department could have flown a plane over to help them, or anybody could have come in and help these people.
Well, theoretically, Jeremy, that's true. But both the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, testified under oath that there were no assets, useful assets, within range that night. But there was one group of military supporters that were sent from Tripoli. So they thought there were these guys coming over from Tripoli, this six-member team that included Glenn Daugherty, who tragically died that night. And unfortunately, there was not the kind of military asset, a gunship or anything else, an armed drone that was in range.
You know, the CIA does not come off looking very good in this film, including the CIA station chief there. What kind of responsibility did he have? And by the way, he was given a medal afterwards.
He was indeed. And look, the CIA base chief was an intelligence officer. He's not a military officer. And he did not see a need for these guys, according to them. You know, I've talked to all the guys who were there on the ground, for them to be there. And he didn't see their value until, of course, that night. And so they felt he was very dismissive of them. He treated them like Walmart security guards, as they put it. And so when everything hits the fan and they want to go and they're ready to go and try to save the people who are under fire, he tells them to wait. He tells them to stand down, in their words. And that becomes a key, that it's the reason why he doesn't come off well. Because let's face it, here's a guy who spent his entire career as an intelligence officer, as an undercover operator. He's not a military strategist. And so when it was a military mission, he was outmatched.
Why do you think that this has become so political? This was a tragedy for obviously the four people who were killed and their families, but also for the United States, the idea that the most powerful nation on earth can't defend itself from some terrorist thugs in a third world country.
If I use the cliche, a perfect storm, I hope I won't get yelled at by my journalism colleagues, but that's really what it was. It was shortly before the 2012 election, at a time when, as we know, America is already enormously polarized and politicized. And then there was, of course, the misunderstandings about what was the source of it and who said what and was it called it. And so it all fed into what we all know to be an enormously politicized moment in American history.
As you know, as happens with movies that are based on real events, this is going to be history for many people. Many people who see this film, this is going to be what they remember and what they know about what happened in Benghazi. Do you have to be careful then about taking the word of some of the people who were involved and not others in telling the story?
I think you always do as a journalist. You're always worried, did I get the full story? And, you know, I would like to hear more from, frankly, the people who were the attackers, from the members of Ansar al-Sharia, who have been not overlooked, but, you know, are obviously hard to get to. So we do have to be careful, and I do understand that for a lot of people this will be history, but I will also say I believe that the essential truths of what happened that night in terms of the attack, in terms of the response, in terms of how it played out are captured in this movie.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in this film, and also, by the way, in Argo, which is about the attack on the embassy in Tehran, is that when an embassy comes under attack, or a diplomatic outpost in this case, they have to destroy all the documents.
That's right.
In this modern day and age, isn't it a little silly that we have all these paper documents that are so sensitive sitting in dangerous places and outposts around the world?
It is. Some of it is digital, but yes, you're suddenly doing shredding and you're setting fire to things, which is kind of amazing in 2012 or 2015. But there is an interesting parallel between the Argo story and 13 Hours in that around the world, when we have 285 or so diplomatic outposts, and there's the expectation that the local government will come to our aid if we ever come under attack on the sovereign property of the United States in an embassy or what have you. And more, I think, in places like Benghazi or places like Iran, we have to be asking the question, can we trust the local government to protect our people?
If, God forbid, another attack like this were to happen, Would the same thing happen today? Do you think that the United States has made the changes that need to be made in order to prevent something like this from happening again?
Well, the State Department has promised they would never have another temporary mission facility like the one in Benghazi that is so lightly protected. But at the same time, you know, history tends to repeat itself here. And so it might not repeat itself exactly the same way as Benghazi. But are there other threats that we perhaps are not prepared for? I think there may be.
Why did you decide to write this book?
You know, as a journalist, I felt I couldn't not write it. These guys sought me out. They had stuck together after Benghazi, and they were looking. They had heard all the politics and the political implications, and they said, you know, no one knows what really happened on the ground, and that's been overlooked. And so when they reached out to me, at first I hesitated in saying, do I really want to get, you know, into the Benghazi business? But you meet them, you talk to them, and you realize as a journalist, I can't not write this book.
Mitch Zuckoff, the author of The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi, which is the book behind the movie 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. Mitch Zuckoff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Jeremy.
We want to check in on the Stanford rape case, part of a national conversation, but a sensitive one, maybe not for all ears. There are now more than 800,000 signatures on a petition to recall California Judge Aaron Persky, who, by the way, won his primary this week unopposed. Persky sentenced former Stanford student Brock Turner to just 6 months in county jail instead of the 6 years in prison prosecutors asked for and the 14 years possible under law after a jury convicted Brock of three felonies, including sexual penetration with a foreign object of an unconscious person. A 23-year-old witnesses found him assaulting behind a dumpster. At sentencing, the judge said Turner had less moral culpability because he was drunk. The father said his life was ruined for 20 minutes of action. The victim's eloquent written courtroom statement has gone viral. Deborah Turkheimer is a professor at the Northwestern University School of Law. Professor, this judge did not make his sentence in a vacuum, right?
That's right. The probation department recommended up to 1 year in jail. And as you say, the prosecutor asked for six.
Well, so someone else was also recommending what's a relatively low sentence in many people's eyes, 1 year. So how does this happen? You know, comparisons are already being made to other cases involving young black men. There was one young black man recently released. He'd been sentenced to, I think, 6 years in jail for a rape he didn't even commit. There's Corey Beatty, the Vanderbilt football star. Same exact situation as Brock Turner. He was seen sexually assaulting an unconscious woman. He claimed it was because he was drunk. He's facing a mandatory 15 to 25 years when he's sentenced. You know, how is it that you have 6 months to a year in Brock Turner's case? Because, you know, people are naturally thinking this is race.
Well, I think there are many reasons for the outrage over this sentence. One, as you point out, is race and the sense that Brock Turner received lenient treatment in part because he's white, because he's a privileged individual. He's an athlete. Corey Beatty is an African-American man, also an athlete. But the sentence differential in those two cases is stark.
Well, the statement has just had incredible reception. Brock Turner, the attacker, said it was a party atmosphere, alcohol, that caused his actions. In her victim statement, the victim said, "Alcohol was not the one who stripped me, fingered me, had my head dragging against the ground." The judge seemed to be sympathetic to the fact that the young man was drunk. How usual is that?
Right. I mean, this idea that when two parties are drinking, there really it can't be blame assigned, I think is one that we're still sort of battling. And I see progress. And I think that the reaction to this sentence is one sign of that progress. But it is the case that when women become intoxicated, they're often blamed for their later assault. And when men become intoxicated and rape, many folks feel as if that, you know, that is some kind of an excuse, and that's a real problem.
What portion of rape cases in the U.S. actually go to trial?
A very small portion. I can give you some sense here based on Bureau of Justice statistics collected and analyzed by RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. So out of every 1,000 rapes, 1,994 perpetrators are going to walk free. So 344 of those cases are reported to police. Only 63 lead to an arrest. 13 get referred to prosecutors. 7 result in a felony conviction. And only 6 of those convicted rapists are incarcerated. So we're talking about a very small number of rapists who are held accountable for what they've done.
Well, why is that?
Oh, there are so many reasons. I mean, I think at every stage of the criminal process, there's still, a sense of a rape as a stranger in an alley with some sort of a weapon. And of course, that's not the vast majority of sexual assaults that are committed. But we still haven't recalibrated the criminal justice response. We still see biases. We still see credibility being judged in ways that reflect these biases. And so there's a lot of, what we might call case attrition in the criminal process.
Well, the recall campaign was started by Stanford Law Professor Michelle Dauber. She told USA Today she's 100% confident he will be recalled. Any final thoughts?
The only other point that I would sort of like to make is that in many respects, I think this case is not a failure, and that the focus on the sentence shouldn't obscure the fact that there was some justice for this victim survivor, that she was believed, and that seemed to make a really big difference to her experience of this awful attack.
Well, yeah, the jury absolutely believed every word the witnesses who rescued her said. So you're saying it's so rare that you even get that far that this should be a victory?
Well, I think it is a modified criminal justice success that when we look across the board and we see the very small number of cases that even make it to a jury verdict, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the criminal process worked in many ways as we would want it to in this instance.
That's Deborah Turkheimer, professor at the Northwestern University School of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some small comfort. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.